From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a John Waters Christmas. The Pope of Trash joins us to play his collection of irreverent and catchy Christmas tunes. Waters is best known for his tasteless and trashy films, including Polyester, Desperate Living, and A Dirty Shame. His film Hairspray became a Tony Award-winning Broadway musical. Also, we remember actor John Spencer. He died last week at age 58. He's best known for his role as the president's chief of staff on the NBC series The West Wing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today we're going to honor the memory of John Spencer, who died a week ago of a sudden heart attack at the age of 58. His character on NBC's The West Wing, former White House Chief of Staff and current vice presidential nominee Leo McGarry, ironically had suffered a heart attack on the show last season. Leo recuperated. John Spencer, the man who brought the lovable Leo to life, did not. Spencer's great strength as an actor in portraying Leo was to convey, all at the same time, a sense of intelligence, a sense of urgency, and a definite sense of humor. On the page, many of his lines, especially the ones written by series creator Aaron Sorkin, may have looked almost minimalistic. But like the dialogue of David Mamet, The West Wing has a definite musical rhythm to its speech. And John Spencer was a virtuoso at hitting all the right notes. Here he is talking to Josh, played by Bradley Whitford, in one of those familiar scenes where the characters trade lines while marching briskly through the White House corridors. In backstage West Wing lingo, these are called walk-and-talk scenes, and Spencer was brilliant in them.
You wanted me?
Yeah, it's all set up.
The meeting?
Yeah.
This is great. Good is gonna come from this.
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah, but how often do you get to...
Yeah.
When's the meeting?
Day after tomorrow.
You're kidding.
No.
Perfect.
We wanted to do it right away.
Yeah.
What's the problem?
Nothing.
What's the problem?
There's a woman I've been...
Amy Gardner.
Yeah.
I hear things.
I know.
I try to forget them quickly, but...
We were supposed to... This is ridiculous, but we were supposed to go away.
Where?
It doesn't matter. We've been having trouble getting together. Day after tomorrow?
Go.
I can't.
Go.
I need a beer for this.
No, you don't.
Don't worry about it.
My wife lives in my house. I live in the hotel. And this is why.
Yeah, okay.
John Spencer won an Emmy for his role as Leo. He also co-starred on L.A. Law and made his first movie appearance in War Games. As a teenager, he was featured on The Patty Duke Show as British cousin Kathy's boyfriend. He acted often on stage, and his other film roles included Presumed Innocent and The Rock. Terry spoke to John Spencer in April of 2000.
Let me ask you about something that happened in a recent episode. Mm-hmm. Your character is a former alcoholic.
That's right.
Who hasn't touched a drink for several years. I forget
right.
How many.
8.
Recently, the fact that he had been to a rehab center was made public by a kind of new aide in the White House. So someone who is very young and very new to this kind of job. Was she an intern?
She was an intern.
Yeah, she worked, an intern. Okay.
Yeah, she worked in the administration office. She really didn't work in the West Wing itself. She was in administration, but that gave her privy to files.
Well, so she secretly makes this file public, you know, that you were in rehab.
She leaked it to a friend socially.
Yeah.
And who was in the opposite political party, and he took the football and ran with it.
When the story is traced back to the intern, she's fired. She comes into your office because you've invited her in.
Mm-hmm.
You talk it through, and then you tell her to keep her job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Being in recovery myself for 10 years, I kind of have an intimacy with the rooms, with AA. And one of the precepts of the program is forgiveness and lack of proselytizing. Share your story. Don't do inventory on other people's points of view. Love and forgive constantly. And I think the turning point for Leo, which I had to find as an actor, I think it is a conversation. He plans to fire her. He asks her why she's done this. And in questioning why she did this, when she comes out with the fact that her father was an alcoholic and his irrationality and strange behavior was so aberrant to her, so horrifying, that this was the only other alcoholic she knew. And suddenly finding out that the chief of staff of the White House of the United States was also an alcoholic, her only point of reference was her old man, was her dad. And as she expresses that, I think myself as Leo have to realize, well, the motivation is a positive one. The result might have been horrible for me and for my friend the president and for our administration, but this woman, it was not kind of nasty, you know, water cooler gossip. It was someone who really feared that it would could be very dangerous, and to have a man with this weakness or this problem in this important position. And when I see that, and I kind of note that she has a love of the government and a love of its responsibility, feeling that she was well motivated, I think I have to give her a second chance. And God knows my character's been given through his life a lot of second chances. So how can you get and not give, you know?
Was the chief of staff character originally written as a recovering alcoholic, or was that aspect of his character written in after you got the part because of your own experience?
Yeah, good question, and often asked me. The truth of the matter is, it was not originally written that way. I have since, because I've been asked this question so many times, gone to Aaron and said, listen, how much did my life influence you there? Because we've talked very rarely about it. I mean, I remember one time going into the soundstage, and I was yet struggling again with the cigarette, no cigarette thing, and we were talking about addiction, and I said, well, this is the last threshold for me, and this is the hardest. And then I started talking about being in recovery. And I don't know if he knew about it before then or not, but it was a very light, casual conversation. And since the episodes have aired that cover this, I've been asked that question a lot because I'm not anonymous and people know that I'm in recovery. So it seems like the obvious question. So I went to Aaron and I asked him if my life influenced his desire to put the character that way. And he said, absolutely not. He said, you know, it was part of his creative imagination, part of his own life experience, knowing people in recovery. And I triggered it off by saying I was in recovery, but he was not basing it on my life.
In TV, you're best known for your roles on L.A. Law and The West Wing. But your first recurring TV role was on The Patty Duke Show.
It certainly was.
As Kathy's boyfriend, the British identical cousin.
The British identical cousin, I forget, what was the role called? Henry Anderson, I think, was the guy's name.
You don't even remember.
Well, I was 16. I'm 53 now, so it was a while ago. Yeah. Well, what a lucky stroke. It was one of the first jobs I ever did in the show business. And I guess there was something in my personality that they thought suited that character, and they just hired the man to play the character the way they wanted, and that's what they got.
Why don't you refresh our memory and describe the character?
I was kind of goofy. It was, kind of a typical teenager in the 60s. I watch some of the reruns every once in a while, and I look particularly tall and skinny to myself with very big ears and the kind of voice that cracked as it got up in the higher register. So it's almost at times if I see that, like I'm watching a different person, you know?
Were you in it from the first episode, or was the character written in later?
It was recurring. I was in the first episode, and I say I would maybe did 10 or 15 of the 22 of the first two seasons. And then the show moved to California because Patty turned 18 and it was working codes and things. She was not under the child labor law any longer, so they could easily do the show in California. And they didn't take any of the recurring people with them to California. So I was only on the first two seasons.
Did she get a new boyfriend?
Kathy kind of played the field, as I remember.
She was such a swinger. No, she wasn't.
No, she wasn't. The other one was. Do you remember the theme song?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, I do too.
Why don't you sing it? I'm not going to.
I can't sing it. I won't go near that. But it's amazing how many people do.
Now, when you were in high school when you got the role?
I was.
Well, could you walk down the halls of your high school without people singing the song to you?
Well, at that point, when I was about 16, I left my New Jersey home and moved into New York City, much to my parents' chagrin. And God bless them for ultimately letting me do this, as petrified as it must have made them. Now, as a 53-year-old man, I look back and realize the horror I must have put them through. And I was pretty rebellious, and I was pretty sure of what I wanted to do. I knew by 8 years old that I wanted to act. Why? Don't ask me. It just seemed a certainty for me in my mind. So I went into New York, and I didn't know the first thing about anything, let alone how to break into this elusive business that I wanted to be a part of. So I got a job as a I wasn't a waiter. They couldn't hire me as a waiter because I was too young and I didn't have working papers. So I was a busboy. And then I found out when the summer was over that I had to go to school if I wanted to work, because I had to get things called working papers, and I needed that up to the point that I was 18. So begrudgingly, I sought out to go back to high school. I thought, you know, 16, you can leave high school. I'll just never see school again. I mean, that's how intelligent I was at that point. And so I enrolled in this high school called Professional Children's School. Not like the Fame High School, the high school portrayed in Fame, which was called the School of the Performing Arts. We were not taught craft things. We were not taught singing, dancing, acting. It was just academics, but it was academics for children, teenagers, high school students, who had working lives. I was in school with Pinchas Zukerman, who at that time was a concert violinist, has since become a very famous conductor. Famous ice skaters, ballet dancers, all of the New York City Ballet was in that school. Actors, we had some rock singers. It was a very eclectic mix of teenagers.
So your circle at the high school included ballet dancers, a soon-to-be famous classical musician.
Liza Minnelli, Jennifer O'Neill.
So where in the ranking of everybody's aspirations was being on the Patty Duke show? Was that seen as like having really made it and great work, or did people look down on that? Like, where did that fit?
No, we were, it's a very interesting thing. I think first and foremost, we were teenagers. We were very concerned with what girl was wearing what and how she looked and who we wanted to date and, you know, cutting school and all the things that teenagers did, except that we had this other life in the workplace. It was not, there was no condescension concerning that. It was, oh my God, you got a gig, how great. You know, these little teenagers with a sort of professional actor outlook of, oh my God, I got the job.
John Spencer speaking with Terry Gross in the year 2000. He died last Friday of a heart attack at age 58. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with John Spencer, who played White House Chief of Staff and Vice Presidential Candidate Leo McGarry on NBC's The West Wing. John Spencer died last Friday at age 58. Terry spoke with him in April of 2000. We'll pick up where we left off, when they were discussing his recurring role as a teenager in the 1960s on TV's The Patty Duke Show.
For a lot of people who grew up with the Patty Duke show, they probably thought that like one day they'd be old enough to go to the malt shop with a date.
Oh, I know.
And, I mean, did the whole idea of what being a teenager was on the Patty Duke show affect your idea of what it meant to be a teenager?
We were kind of different teenagers, a little more jaded, a little more worldly wise, a little more out there. Because we had no time to go to the malt shops. We were either at the studio or trying to make up homework.
I'm not sure you could have found a malt shop like that in Manhattan.
We had a place called Rudley's, which was right by the school. It was a coffee shop, no longer there. The Gulf Western building is there now. And we would often, I'm talking out of school here, Terry. We would often cut classes and hang out there and drink Coca-Colas and eat English muffins and smoke cigarettes, a habit that I picked up early on and I'm still trying to get rid of.
It's hard. It is really hard.
Oh, boy. It seems to me my Achilles heel. This is now my third attempt. I stopped for 18 weeks and then very cavalierly over Christmas decided, okay, I'm strong. I'll have a few cigarettes. I'm on vacation. Well, there was a really stupid point of view, because within 3 or 4 days I was smoking completely again.
So you're trying to stop again?
I've just been hypnotized. That was not the greatest tool. So I'm going to go back to the patch and Zyban, which I used and kept me free for 18 weeks. Actually, I used them for 12, and 6 weeks I was totally clean. So well, I know that to work, so I'm going to try that again.
Your character on West Wing doesn't smoke, does he?
Not at all.
That's good, because you wouldn't have to smoke. You wouldn't.
No, I
that would
made
really
that
hurt
as
to
a,
have to smoke to be in character.
Absolutely. I made that as a conscious choice. Also, the White House is a smoke-free area.
Of course.
So we'd have to run outside to have one. Do you smoke?
Oh, I gave it up a long time ago.
How'd you do that? Cold turkey, or did you use tools?
Well, I'll tell you what happened to me. I lost my voice twice on the air because I had a cold and I was smoking
That'll do it, won't it?
Yeah. And I realized, you know, this is going to be really awful if I lose my voice again like this. So that it definitely inspired me to stop. And I didn't. I just stopped.
You did.
Yeah, I mean, I was sick when I stopped. I had a really bad cold, no voice, so it was easy to get through that and then keep going. But I had stopped, you know, an amazing number of times before that and started again.
It's a squirrely habit. It really gets you.
It really
does. If I had to do it again, one of the regrets in my life is ever starting. And I remember my father, I was, I guess I was 15. We were in an airport, and I was running to get something, and I gave him my coat to hold. And I came back, and his demeanor had totally changed, and he had obviously gone in my pocket and found this pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
And we had this huge fight in the airport, I remember. And, of course, nothing he said meant anything to me. He was an old man with no knowledge of what I was going through. And I remember his words ingrained in my mind today of, "You will regret this day, John, believe me. You will come to the point where you will wish you had never done this." And he was right. Father knows best.
There's some actors who did some pretty great bits of business with cigarettes. You know, Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall. I mean,
absolutely.
You just you remember how they looked when they smoked. When you were starting acting and smoking, was a cigarette a really good prop for you?
Absolutely. I taught myself. I stood in front of a mirror in the upstairs bathroom and taught myself to smoke. I smoked and I thought, this doesn't look right. This doesn't look like other people. And so, you know, I kind of did that, holding them with the first three fingers. You
oh,
know,
yes,
that
kinda right.
Tough look.
Yeah,
And then I thought, it still doesn't look right. And I realized I wasn't inhaling. I didn't know what inhaling was. So why isn't it coming out of my nose? And I took a deep breath and it came out of my nose. The room started spinning around. I was sick on the bed. And the next day I started again. And with enough practice, I learned how.
Do you have a favorite smoking scene from your movies?
From my movies? Let me think. Not really, but I loved the concept that David Kelly wrote my first episode of L.A. Law. Mulaney was a smoker, they often let me smoke on that show. I believe after a while, the character became very popular, and NBC got very worried that I was a good guy smoking, and there was some pressure from the network that I shouldn't smoke on the show. But that came the second and third season. The first season, I smoked like a fiend. In fact, there was one scene I remember where Leland McKenzie, Richard Dysart, walked in my, opened the door, and like smoke poured out of my office. But my first litigation, my first case was a secondary smoke suit, where I got the client millions of dollars and attacked the cigarette companies, where in between scenes I was smoking like a wild thing. And I loved that dynamic. I thought that was so great and so David Kelly, that kind of, complex situation.
You know, it's funny, a lot of actresses complain that when they hit their 40s, the roles dry up. Your career really took off in your 40s and 50s.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about why that is.
I do. I was a character actor in a young man's body. I don't think people knew what to do with me in my 20s. You know, because I wasn't Matt Dillon, or I wasn't your typical young leading man. Yet I also wasn't so much of a character actor that, you know, I could play the occasional really offbeat sidekick. I fell somewhere in the middle and therefore in the cracks. As my face began to age and more meet the roles, things got better and better. I'm one of those examples of it getting better and better with time. The older I got, the better it got. And I think that's because of the character actor syndrome. Really, it's very hard for the industry to find what to do with young character actors. Men, bad enough. Women, almost impossible. And so we have to wait it out, you know, which is a hard dynamic. But my real view about acting is, unless you need it like an opiate, unless you really, I mean, you jones for it, you can't live without it, I would do something else. There are so many other things that are easier on the soul, more lucrative, more steady. But if you need your art and it's undeniable to you, then you don't have a choice. That's why when young actors ask me, do I think they should act? I say no, because unless they know they have to act, I don't think it's worth it. It's hard enough when it's going well. If it's not going well, it's impossible.
John Spencer, speaking to Terry Gross in the year 2000. He won an Emmy for his role as Leo McGarry on The West Wing in 2002 and died last Friday of a heart attack. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Anne Bronte's neglected novel, Agnes Grey, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, in stores and online. From The Dial Press, publisher of Women's Letters, America from the Revolutionary War to the Present, edited by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen J. Adler. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, here comes Fatty Claus and other obscure Christmas music. It's a John Waters Christmas.
The ground is covered with white. Santa's coming tonight with dolls and toys for girls and boys and a merry ho, ho, ho. There'll be sleigh bells, reindeer and snow, and a merry Christmas. Santa's bringing a sled painted yellow and red. Mom and Dad are feeling glad because tonight they know there'll be sleigh bells, reindeer and snow. Jump into bed, cover over your head, and lie there still until you hear that merry ho, 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 with his sleigh bells, reindeer, and snow.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows. All of the other reindeer used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join.
As if you couldn't tell, that's Tiny Tim, and it's one of the least unusual tracks on the CD A John Waters Christmas. It's an anthology of catchy, entertaining, and ridiculous Christmas records, selected by filmmaker John Waters. He spoke with Terry last year about the collection. Waters has had a lifelong fascination with the odd and unusual. His movies include the cult classic Pink Flamingos, which established his reputation as the king of bad taste. Waters' more recent and more mainstream movie, Hairspray, was adapted into a hit Broadway musical. And now that musical is being adapted into a movie. Waters also has other irons in the fire, including a new reality-based series about to premiere on Court TV. It's called Till Death Do Us Part. Each episode deals with a real-life spousal murder and opens with a reenactment of the wedding. Waters will serve as host, or as he calls it, the groom reaper. Sounds tacky, even tasteless? Welcome to John Waters territory. As we'll hear, the opening track of A John Waters Christmas has a special connection to Waters. Here it is, Fat Daddy is Santa Claus.
I'm Fat Daddy. I'm Santa Claus. Woo, woo, yeah. I'm Fat Daddy. The reindeer boss. I pack my sleigh with goodies and toys. You know I'm on my way to greet all the good little girlies and boys.
That's Fat Daddy, featuring Fat Daddy from A John Waters Christmas. John Waters, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Who is Fat Daddy?
Fat Daddy was a DJ in Baltimore, one of the very most popular ones. When I was a teenager, he was on WSID, and later he was on the Buddy Dean Show, which I based Hairspray on, and he hosted Negro Day, and they actually called it that. And he would wear an imperial margarine crown and a long cloak, and he inspired the character that's in Hairspray the movie and the Broadway musical of Motormouth Maybelle. He talked like that fast, like, ooh, poppity diddle, I'm Fat Daddy. And he had this song called Fat Daddy that was a Christmas carol that was certainly a big hit only in Baltimore, as far as I know, and had been out of print for a long, long time. So that was one of the main reasons I wanted to do the John Waters Christmas, was to get the Fat Daddy Christmas carol back in print. In Baltimore in the early 60s, all cool white kids and all black kids listened to Fat Daddy. It was really the first way that we heard rhythm and blues. He then went on the Buddy Dean Show. He was very, very loved by the teen community and all the black community in Baltimore, certainly. We had great black radio stations in Baltimore, WSID, WEBB, WWIN, and sometimes if the weather was good, we could get WANN from Annapolis with Hoppy Adams, the only station that would play What I Say Part 2.
What was Negro Day like?
Negro Day was all black kids dancing, but the difference was on the Buddy Dean Show, they had regulars on White Day, which was every day, and that was a line in the Broadway musical, but basically, they had a white committee, it was called, and it was regulars on the show that got fan mail, and they did close-ups, and the committee had to come to work every day, really, and their job was to ask guests to dance. There was no black committee. They were just all guests, and it was one day, maybe a month, or I'm not sure how often it was on, but it was on, and Fat Daddy would be the host that day. There were no white people on Negro Day, and there were no black people on White Day, and the show later went off the air because of when it was integrated by girls that started ironing their hair instead of having teased hair. And, of course, in the movie, I gave it a happy ending. I integrated the show. That did not really happen in real life.
Mm. So what were the criteria that you used to select the records for A John Waters Christmas?
Well, I wanted to have an album that what it would be like if you came over to my house at Christmas and I got all my old records out and played you my favorite Christmas carols. I work with a guy named Larry Banashevitz, who has this incredible record collection. I have worked with him since Crybaby on all my movies, and he helps me unearth. He has these insane Christmas classics, my kind of classics. classic. Certainly, I wanted to put songs on here that probably no one did know. Many of them, there's a few people know, like the Chipmunks and Tiny Tim, probably, but many of the other ones are almost unknown to most people. And I don't think any of these songs are campy. I think a few are awful, but they're so awful, they're perfect. And I don't think any of them really were hipster songs. I think that they were serious Christmas songs that somehow were just too eccentric or went awry for the regular public to ever really possibly have success with them.
Let's hear another song from a John Waters Christmas. This is a doo-wop track. It's called Christmas Time Is Coming, a street carol performed by Stormy Weather. Why did you choose this one?
I chose it because it reminded me when I first grew up in Lutherville, Maryland, and near where I lived was a segregated little black part of the community. And a lot of the people that lived there walked past my house at night singing a cappella, and I'd be like an 8-year-old kid lying in bed at night and hear it. And I use that in Hairspray the movie very much, that image. And it just felt liberating to me to hear this music, and it sounded so beautiful outside my house. So it just seemed to be a Christmas carol that reminded me of that.
All right. Well,
and I had a very white Christmas in all meaning of that word. And this was a little bit different and a little bit something that seemed more exciting to me.
Okay, so this is Christmas Time Is Coming.
Do, do, do. Christmas time is here.
Do, do, do.
Christmas time is here.
Christmas time is coming.
Do, do, do.
There's snow falling
do, do, do.
On the street.
Do, do, do.
The holidays are near.
Do, do, do.
Shoppers buying
do, do.
Christmas trees.
Do, do, do.
We'll have a ball.
Sing
at all.
Christmas time is here.
Christmas time is here. The New Year's Eve is coming. We'll all sing the old Lang Syne. I'll whisper in your ear. I'll be yours, so please be mine.
We'll have a ball. Sing
at
all.
Christmas time is here.
Christmas time is here.
This is the time for love.
A track from the new CD, A John Waters Christmas, and John Waters is my guest. There's a line in that song that sounds like the same line from the Dream Lover song, When We Get Married. We'll have a ball, mm-hmm. dancing and all. I wonder who got it from who.
I don't know. You know, sometimes these songs, when I have the records, they didn't even have the dates on them. Some were later than you thought, and some were much earlier.
Yeah.
There's a song on here, Happy Birthday Jesus by Little Cindy, that's one of my favorites. And I have no idea when that movie came out. Is Little Cindy alive? Does she know she's back out there in front of the public? Because you listen to that song, and my imagination gets carried away. I think of maybe like in the South somewhere in some pitiful little recording studio, and Little Cindy, maybe the JonBenet of her community, has been forced to come in there and sing this song in a torn Rhoda Penmark party dress, and even the mistakes are left in. There's only one take with Little Cindy. She didn't get a second take. And that's, to me, the most fascinating piece of the song is trying to picture Little Cindy singing Happy Birthday Jesus. And later, Patti Page covered that song.
Why don't we hear it?
This is
Little Cindy, Happy Birthday Jesus, A Child's Prayer.
A house so quiet and humble, a child beside her bed, her hands clasped tightly, it's time to pray. So she bows her little head.
Happy birthday, Jesus. Mama said that you was near, and that you had a birthday this time every year. She told me how you listen to every word we say, and that you hear us calling in the night or in the day. She explained how bad they hurt you, those awful naughty men, but said you let them do it, for girls like me would sin. She said about the manger they took and put you in. I'd let you have my blanket if I was here back then. She said that you were watching everything we do. Her and Daddy and Granny and our new baby, too. I like when Mama told me of how you healed the lame and that they didn't have to have any wealth or fame. She told you us so often.
That's Happy Birthday, Jesus by Little Cindy from the CD A John Waters Christmas. John Waters spoke to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with John Waters.
What were the records that you loved and hated most on the radio Christmas time when you were growing up?
I always really hated the little drummer boy. I wish Old Dirty
Bastard.
I wish Old Dirty Bastard had recorded that before he died. I think it would have been a great Christmas album. I hated the corny ones you just heard over and over, like the Muzak versions. I like sometimes when they did a punk rock version of it, mm-hmm. or if the Chipmunks did it, or I always liked a twist on it. Santa Claus is a Black Man, to me, is the mother lode of all crackpot Christmas carols. Not because I believe Santa Claus is a Black Man is such an odd idea. It was just such an odd, great black Kwanzaa song that came out, and I remembered it from Baltimore, and I really, really loved it because it starts with a kid singing, and then the dad comes in, and then the mother comes in, and she sounds amazing. And it's almost like you expect the Chipmunks to come in, which they do on another record. The Chipmunks are a great presence in my life. We can get to that in a minute. But so this song I didn't have. Even Larry Benishevitz did not have this song.
We should hear Santa Claus is a Black Man. And so this is something you grew up with?
Well, I heard it in the 70s on the radio, and
well,
I loved
so,
it.
Yeah, you were already a filmmaker.
I was already on pot. I probably heard it on marijuana at that period of my life. And it was such a great song to me. It seemed liberating so much. And when you hear it today, when he says, Daddy, he had an afro like yours, happy Kwanzaa. Oh, it's just great to me. It's just very, very touching to me.
This is Santa Claus is a Black Man from the new CD, A John Waters Christmas, and it's performed by Akim and the Teddy Van Production Company.
Yep, and Akim is the kid, and I guess Teddy Van's the dad, I would imagine.
All right, well, I guess we'll never really know unless somebody calls us and tells us. Okay.
Please, little Cindy, if you're hearing this, call. What's a number?
Well, here's the record.
Hey, you want me?
Kimmy?
He looked a lot like you. He was handsome.
I can dig it.
He was black.
Right on.
He had an afro. He was really out of sight. Now I'm going to tell everybody that I saw Santa.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Santa Claus is a black man. Santa Claus is a black man. His hands down blind with daddy's blue. Yes, he is. Santa Claus is a black man.
Did you ever believe in Santa Claus?
Yes, I did believe in Santa Claus. There's a picture of me. My parents have a picture of myself sitting on Santa Claus's lap. Yes, I believed it. Sometimes I get confused and wonder if the Santa Claus knew my guardian angel. But Santa Claus, I did believe in. And eventually you hear things in school. And it is weird that your parents lie to you about all that early. But I guess it's fair. It's a good belief. I do like Christmas for real, without irony. So obviously I had a happy home at Christmas. There's a picture in my parents' scrapbook that always sort of sums up what my life was going to be like. I guess I was about 10 years old, and I'm under the tree with my presents, and in one hand I have a hand puppet, because I had asked for that, and I was a puppeteer at children's birthday parties at the time, and in the other hand is the Genius of Ray Charles album that I had asked for. And it's such a weird picture, because my parents went and bought me that album, and I guess that showed that even though they knew then I wasn't fitting in, that they were supportive as they knew how to be at the time.
Oh, that's great. Now, I'm amazed that you do Christmas without irony at your house, because, I mean, you seem so constantly
now
to be
you
about
mean?
Irony.
I do love Christmas today without irony. I'm not saying there isn't some irony in my house at Christmas. Certainly, my sister-in-law does a wreath for me out of sticker bushes that rips at your clothes and scratches you when you come in my door. Someone did make for me a set of Christmas balls that are serial killers. That actually, it was a funny gift. You can make them for your friends, too. You could make badly dressed terrorists. You could do all sorts of themes. You just buy cheap Christmas balls and cut pictures out and glue them on Christmas balls, and it looks nice. It's a nice gift you can give other people at Christmas. Your family, if you've run out of ideas, I might suggest that.
I guess I'd be disappointed if you did anything without a degree of bad taste and irony. But what's the non-ironic part of Christmas for you?
Well, you know, I have three brothers and sisters, so every 4 years it's my turn to cook the whole Christmas dinner for my family, my parents, and I do that. I did it last year, so I have 3 years off now. I can go to the other ones. Certainly, Christmas morning, my parents come over, we give each other presents. I don't think there's a lot of irony involved in that. You know, I don't give my mother whoopee cushions or anything. You know, it certainly is as traditional as it can be without being, you know, ridiculous. It's not Leave It to Beaver's family. But certainly, I do like Christmas. I've had the same Christmas party for 40 years. In the early days, it was always at least 100 people. And in the early days, every person was expected to buy a present for all 100 people. So there would be 10,000 presents in the house. And those were the days when you could find things for a quarter in a thrift shop. But it was frightening when everybody started opening them. It was an orgy of gift opening.
Wow.
I still have to buy about 70 Christmas presents every year.
Where do you go shopping for Christmas gifts? Do you do flea markets? Where do you go?
No, I don't do flea markets, actually. I mostly give everybody I know books. Almost every person gets books. So I go to bookshops, and there's special ones I go to in each city. I can't wait to go to San Francisco. My favorite bookshop is there called K.O. Books that specializes in uncollectibles. It's amazing.
They uncollectibles? Have
like,
what is that?
Yeah. Well, it means like movie tie-ins, movie novelizations, sex books. They have a whole series about abortion, juvenile delinquency. It's the most amazing bookshop, and you can find the best gifts there because it's very greatly priced. It's fairly priced, and there's books you've just never seen there that are so hilarious, and it's a great place to find good Christmas presents. And I don't own it. I'm not giving it a plug of something I own.
John Waters speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with John Waters.
Okay, it's time for another track from a John Waters Christmas, your new CD. And I'm going to go with something very conventional here. Because okay. Most of the records we've been hearing, we don't really know the genealogy of the recording, because they're like found records. But this is Alvin and the Chipmunks,
mm-hmm.
Which you say figured prominently into your childhood.
Yes.
I think everybody who grew up in, I guess it was like the late 50s, grew up with Alvin and the Chipmunks. Why do you care about them?
Well, I think they're sexy, actually.
I mean, they're sexy?
A bad boy in a band. Actually, in real life, if people talk fast, I'm turned on. I'm always hoping that someone will be talking so fast that they go into chipmunk talk, and then I can ask them to marry me. I have the hots for the Chipmunks, Terry. It's a hard thing to explain. I like a bad boy in a band. Wasn't that Alvin? There was also fake chipmunks that tried to rip off their title called the Squirrels. They were lower-level chipmunks. I love the idea. Sometimes I can make all my records be sung by the Chipmunks if you just play it at the wrong speed. The difference is the Chipmunks, the music is at the right speed. The voice is at the wrong speed. So I've always been fascinated by them. I want them to continue. The Chipmunks can't die. I don't get why there's not new Chipmunk songs. I've just always been fascinated by them from the moment I heard them. They even did a punk rock album that was quite good, too, that came out in the 70s.
The Chipmunks did a punk rock album?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Chipmunk Punk, it's called. I have it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh.
So I want them to do a rap album. Wouldn't the Chipmunks rapping be great?
So this is Alvin and the Chipmunks singing Sleigh Ride from the new CD, A John Waters Christmas. Alvin and the Chipmunks, featured on the new anthology A John Waters Christmas, and filmmaker John Waters is my guest. Would you be interested in recommending some good movies for the holiday?
Yeah, I know a movie I really, really liked. It's called Jesus You Know, and it's made by this guy named Ulrich Seidel, a director in Vienna I like very much, who made a really depressing movie called Dog Days that I liked very much. It's just people coming in churches and saying their prayers out loud to the camera, which is one of the most maddening films I've ever seen. And you realize that if the whatever the supreme being is had to listen to really what everybody say in their prayers, he or she would lose their mind from listening to people's prayers. And it's an amazing movie. I'm amazed that it has distribution. The only other woman in the theater when I went was the woman in that documentary Cinemania that goes to five movies a day.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she was there. And I feel so bad because I'm just so amazed that this movie got out there, so I would recommend seeing that quickly. That's my favorite holiday movie.
Do you have any favorite, like, Christmas movies?
Yes.
That you would recommend for renting on the holidays?
Yes. It's called Christmas Evil, and it's about a guy,
a lonely man.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Christmas Evil. It's about a lonely man that one day while he's shaving with shaving cream on his face realizes he looks like Santa Claus. So he gets a job in a toy factory. He starts spying on children. He gets a little book and writes down good little boy, bad little girl. He starts cross-dressing as Claus and passes. As Christmas gets near, he creepy crawls around people's roofs and finally takes the plunge on Christmas Eve and goes down a chimney, gets caught, stuck, irate parents, starts screaming. He panics, grabs a razor-sharp ornament off the tree, cuts the parents' throat, and run. And then there's a mob of parents trying to get him, but all the children in the community believe he's real, and they perform a protective ring around him, and then he takes off on the sleigh, getting away with murder. It's an amazing movie.
Is it a comedy or a horror film?
To me, it's a religious film. It's, I suppose, a horror film.
Well, I'd like to close with another record from your anthology of John Waters' Christmas, and I'm going to let you choose this last one.
Well, the song I'd like to play is one that I think it's a touching, beautiful song. It's called Santa Don't Pass Me By. It's kind of a lonely song about a man who wants to get home for Christmas, and he's hitchhiking, and he's hoping Santa will pick him up. I love to hitchhike. I still do. It's my midlife crisis. I hitchhike a lot, actually, in the summer. And I have a sign in Provincetown that says the beach where I go, and I have hitchhiking dates. I ask people, you want to go on a hitchhiking trip with me? And it's a great fun for me. It's my midlife crisis. Other men get sport cars. I hitchhike. So I wanted to, it was important to me to have a song on there about hitchhiking. And I guess that would be the ultimate ride, wasn't it? If you're hitchhiking and Santa Claus picks you up.
A nice fantasy. Well, John Waters, thank you so much. Merry Christmas.
Same to you. And happy holidays and Kwanzaa.
And thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Terry, for having me.
John Waters speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. His CD anthology is called A John Waters Christmas.
I'm gonna hitch a ride with old Saint Nick, for I'm sure he'll pass your way. Yes, I'll be home for Christmas if there's room on Santa's sleigh.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley. Happy holidays from all of us at Fresh Air.
Please, please, Santa Claus.
Support for NPR comes from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. And from Universal Pictures, presenting Munich, directed by Steven Spielberg and starring Eric Bana, Daniel Craig, and Jeffrey Rush, in select cities December 23rd. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look back at 2005 with some of our favorite interviews. We kick off the week with Thelma Schoonmaker, who's been Martin Scorsese's film editor since the beginning of his career. She won Academy Awards for her work on Raging Bull and The Aviator. Join us for the next Fresh Air.